This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Today's podcast is part of our Weed Week coverage. This whole week has been leading into April 20th or 420, where there's many celebrations, both formal and informal, about pot and pot use in the country. Has been called Weed Week, and we're participating in that.
Like, personally?
No, and that's my guess. We'll get to her in a second.
Podcasts.
So as pot prohibition is ending, we're moving into a new and exciting era in terms of thinking about all sorts of other drugs and how to use them to make ourselves happier and more fulfilled. This is especially true of hallucinogens and psychedelics, which are experiencing a huge renewal of interest, and by some measures, but not by all, also a huge interest in use and people actually using this stuff. Today's guest, Sarah Rose Siskind, is at the forefront of this discussion. Some of you may remember her as the co-writer, or the head writer, excuse me, of Mostly Weekly.
Well, there's only two writers, you know, being co-writer and head writer is 50-50 shot. Well,
and obviously she's already busting in on the introduction. We're going to let her talk in a minute, probably. But right now, one of the things that she does is she hosts a monthly show called Drug Test, which takes place at Manhattan's Caveat Theater and features drug experts, scientists, a VIP or very intoxicated person, and deeply researched, fast-paced, and fun conversation about better living through chemistry. Sarah, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me. I've said all I need to say. I'm just going to leave now.
That makes sense. Okay, fair enough. But give me the elevator pitch for Drug Test. Describe, what it is and what do you hope to accomplish with it?
Drug Test is a drug education show in the Lower East Side. That is an absolutely insane harebrained scheme that I managed to get away with, where essentially I...
So you're actually, most of the time, you're drilling into the bank vault that's below the theater?
Yeah, okay. It's all a cover. Yeah. I'll get there eventually. Essentially, each show is a drug, and each drug we give to our guest of honor or VIP, very intoxicated person. And then I invite three experts and celebrities and people who should know better to come on the show, look at clips of me doing science experiments with our VIP on the drug and explain what's going on in that person's
right.
brain.
And you film before the show, film the person both like kind of in baseline motor skills and mental tasks.
Right. So
and then
that
when they're high. Yeah.
Exactly. And I've had really interesting combinations. I've had a pole dancer on LSD. I've had a male model on magic mushrooms. I had a cancer researcher on ketamine. I've had, what else? I've had an AI researcher on MDMA. Mm. And so I just kind of like, essentially, I made into a job the idea of doing drugs with cool people.
Right. And then you have the experts talking about, what the drug is, what its characteristic effects are and things like that.
Yeah. And it's loosely based off the clips. Honestly, the person taking the drugs is meant to be sort of an inroad for people to be like, okay, this is our through line. This is a person we have been introduced to. We kind of understand. And then it's sort of a jumping off point for the experts to talk about why their behavior might be that way.
So you said it's a drug education program, and we're going to talk about what I like to call a post-prohibitionist mindset, which I think your show is really is illustrative of and has taken root in culture as the drug war. I really get ahead of myself by saying that the drug war is over because recreational pot is legal at the state level in a bunch
there
of places.
Are a couple of people who might disagree
with
you in prison.
We have a couple of winter offensives and A-bombs to drop before victory is declared, but it's at the forefront of that. But what do you hope to accomplish by having the show?
So one of the things I think very deeply about is what does the world look like after the drug war? Because I actually don't think that the drug war really operates on the legal level mostly. I think it operates on a psychological, cultural level mostly. And so what does it look like when we have these extremely powerful chemicals readily available for people to use? And are they going to use them well? Because people die and people find reasons to live with like the same chemicals. And we need to establish a culture that is flexible enough and thoughtful enough to steer people towards the beneficial effects of drugs. And I think that we can oftentimes get bogged down in the one objective of legalizing drugs so much that we don't even appreciate what peace looks like.
So, and by that, I mean, you know, the obvious, or I won't speak for you, for myself, I mean, the obvious effect of ending the drug war is that it changes the carceral state, it changes law enforcement, people who are in prison will no longer be in prison, criminal black market activity will move into, you know, viable open commercial activity. But you're talking about a much broader issue, too, of like, what does peace look like? How do people use these drugs in order to live their lives?
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the most interesting things about drug use, especially in particular the case of psilocybin or magic mushrooms, is the way people will talk about their experiences. I remember I was talking to a friend and I was like, oh my gosh, this was such an incredible experience. I died. I felt the feeling of dying. And she was like, what are you talking about? I took magic mushrooms and I died. Like, I actually felt like I was dying. We had the exact same experience. But in my case, I was marveling at the fact that you could get the chance to experience something like dying and have the story to tell on the other side. And she had the exact opposite experience. And if she had sort of had a better education towards how psilocybin works, she might understand.
She would have had your experience, which is by definition superior to hers.
Well,
right?
I don't use words like superior. I would say words like productive, maybe.
Yeah. Generative.
Yeah. I'm positive. Trying not to be too normal because, you know, everybody's experience is their own experience.
But this is the idea of building a culture of drug use and acceptance where people have more information to share as well as kind of protocols to go through or rituals, things like that.
And so what's interesting is for certain hallucinogens, they have traditions of not just centuries, but in some cases, like I think millennia of experience of use. And there is some amount of etiquette developed around that. But if we were to completely adopt that, then we would have people taking magic mushrooms and then human sacrificing them. So maybe not all the etiquette should be kept. But a lot of psychedelic culture has been only established in the last 50 or 60 years.
Right. And always under bizarre kind of, not always, but often under very repressive circumstances. So,
I mean,
the electric Kool-Aid acid test where you might end up being busted even before the Grateful Dead gets on stage.
Exactly. And there's a culture of fear around drug use. Like it is very strange to take a drug in, like people who do ayahuasca ceremonies in Peru, they'll often talk about one of the strangest things is just being vocal about I'm on a drug out in public. And that's expected.
Because you never meet your friends at parties where they're like, I'm so fucked up. I'm so fucked up. But yeah.
Never
no, happened. But it's huge. And it's going to require a lot on the part of people who are positive towards drug use or towards putting currently illegal or illicit, I'm making air quotes, substances onto a spectrum with illegal pharmacopoeia, which is also expanded.
So just to your original question about like sort of the cultures built around this stuff in an illegal atmosphere, I grew up in the Bay Area. And one of the things I was fascinated with was the culture around weed, appropriate for Weed Week. Like, it was just common knowledge that when you're smoking with friends, it's two puffs and then pass. And that was something that nobody had ever told me. I never remembered hearing a lesson, though there's a whole rap song about it. But it was a type of etiquette. Because you obviously don't want to hog the whole thing. And there are...
In earlier generations, called that bogarting a joint.
Bogarting the joint. Okay, thank you for this cross-generational input. But, you know, it's because when you think about it, there are very few activities you do with your friends. You don't share drinks, you know? Like, so you have to come up with etiquette when you're sharing a joint. And I was always fascinated by how those emerge, that type of consideration. Also, things like... how do you deal with people who are too high? You know, like they're, you sort of tried and trial and error, you learn, like, don't tell people you're too high. Like for example,
I didn't realize this is like a journey through my past, but
okay,
yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm getting too into that. But, it reminds me of frankly, like, just to veer into how to talk to people who are too high. It reminds me of a story. When I was a kid, my sisters convinced me that my toes needed to breathe. I was like 16. No, I was like 5. and I couldn't go to pool parties because I couldn't swim. And I would just stick my toes out of the water. And I talked to my father about this. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I got this problem. And he said, yes, your sisters are right. Your toes do need to breathe. But they have an incredible lung capacity. They can hold their breath for an hour and a half. So just so long as you bring your toes out of the water every hour and a half, you'll be fine. And that type of approach is the approach you want with a high person. Like, don't immediately challenge what they're saying, because their mind is in a certain type of thought process that you're not going to challenge their systems of thought. But if you sort of take an improviser's approach, you yes and their mode of thinking, you can steer them towards more productive lines of thinking.
Who shows? I've been to staging of the show, or an episode, I don't know what you call it, performance. And there were, it looked like there were about 150 people there. You're pulling a big audience to the Lower East Side on Sunday nights to talk about drug use. I guess this is, yeah, you know, you go right from church, you get a, you right. have a, you know, night. A sandwich, and then you go to the drug show, or drug test. But, and they're paying, you know, $20 a throw or so to get in. Who shows up for the show, and what do they like about it?
People looking for drugs. That's not my primary demographic. No, with a show like this, you really can't rely on your family coming, like your parents showing up. So I was really happy that anyone showed up. It's mostly unfortunately for me, it's people already pretty educated in drug use, because I really do want the show to be for all people.
You
want
to take this
opinions.
To every grammar school or elementary school across the country?
Luckily the bar has a 21 limit. Okay. Like, you have to be 21. But I have actually done a show on the road where there was a 13-year-old in the audience. And I was surprised at how accepting his parents were when I talked about the impetus of the show. And I think that what's interesting is that parents nowadays have taken a different approach to drug education with their children, which is, frankly, like, we learned abstinence only doesn't work with sex, so why do we think it'll work with drugs? Instead, we should be saying, like...
Although it is true, there's a sex drought going on, so there's, you know, maybe abstinence...
I haven't heard of this. But I think that if you take that mode of approach with sex, you can take it with drugs, and... It's much more of a harm reduction mode of drug education.
You've been doing the show for several months now. How is it evolving?
So it used to be a show where you would actually watch a clip of somebody on a drug, and then the audience would have to guess what drug they took. And it was actually called What Drug Did I Take? Because I'm very creative with drug titles. But the problem was, my audience was so educated about drug use that they were, you know, they were asking questions like, you know, what was the onset of the drug? What was the method of ingestion? And they pretty easily understood. And I was running out of prizes to give people. So I evolved the show to be much more about, okay, we know the drug. Let's examine each drug very dedicatedly.
So how do you pick the drugs? Because you've mostly done psychedelics or hallucinogenics, and I realize there are, you know, are various ways of defining these terms more tightly or loosely. But why those drugs, and you know, how do you pick which one?
I had been starting off with psychedelics, but I actually part company with a lot of my new friends in this space. When I say that I don't draw such strict categories between psychedelics and other types of drugs. As a matter of fact, for my next show, I'm strongly considering doing Ambien as our topic, because I think it has strong hallucinatory effects. I mean, that's on the side of the box, is hallucinations. Yeah. It's actually interesting. Like, on the side of the box of a lot of drugs, the side effects will be things like diarrhea, but also euphoria. And it's always interesting to me that those are the same category.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, it's all on a spectrum. Right. You know, it's a gradient.
But I think that drugs are on a spectrum as well. And that we make a lot of strong divisions about the kind of people who take psychedelics and the kind of people who take crack cocaine or heroin. And one of the best examples is, like, somewhat controversially, I think the opioid epidemic we're currently in is not so different from the crack epidemic in the 80s. It's a group of disenfranchised people self-medicating and looking to remove pain, psychological and or physical. But I think that we've changed our understanding of drugs based off of how much we can relate to the people taking them.
Mm-hmm. Or that we assume are taking them, right? Because crack was not simply, I mean, it was set, the sale of crack was set in black urban communities, but it didn't necessarily mean only blacks were taking crack. But that's
true. And it also doesn't mean that only white people are taking opioids.
Right.
Like, I actually just last week went to this New York City Department of Hygiene seminar where you get free Narcan at the end of sitting through the seminar. And I've never been in, and the seminar itself was about opioid overdose prevention.
Right. Narcan is the drug that you can inject in somebody who's ODing on an opiate. Opioid, and it helps them.
It
helps them survive.
It's not as Pulp Fiction as you think. It's actually a nasal spray.
Yeah.
So I was sitting through this really fascinating seminar, and two interesting things came up. One, it was the most racially diverse room I've ever been in. And two, the other really interesting thing was that the language used by this civil servant was such that she was doing her utmost to destigmatize users of opioids. She was saying, like, don't call them drug abusers, call them people who use drugs. Mm. Like, it was, I mean, you know.
Users of drugs rather than drug users.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Don't call it fentanyl. Call it, like, you know, fentanyl.
Call it one of the most widely
used
drugs in medical operations.
A carrot. It was a little bit obsequious at some points. But it
does, in a weird way, and I guess it's somewhat off-putting for the people who were kind of caught with the rhetoric of the war on crack and what happened to that. It's a better understanding now.
I was really surprised how empathetic, frankly, she was when talking about these people who take up so much of the city's resources and are doing something illegal. She was even like, this is a, you know, civil servant employed by the New York City government telling you how to avoid laws, to avoid incriminating yourself. She was saying there's a Good Samaritan law where if you report an overdose or you are overdosing, you will not be tried for possession. And she literally, one person asked her, what if we were with a group of people? Does it apply to a group? And she took a minute and she said, in most cases, everybody else leaves when the police show up or when the ambulance shows up. And she was essentially telling this person, ask your other friends to leave so that they won't be tried. She was literally giving people advice about how not to incriminate yourself because she knows that that is more likely to get people to report an overdose and to save lives. So it was weird seeing a civil servant talking about how to avoid these laws because, you know, she's trying to save lives more than she's trying to lock up quote-unquote criminals.
Each show of drug test is built around a different drug. What's been the most interesting drug so far, do you think, and why, that you've done a show on?
I would say interesting for the audience and then interesting for me is sort of two different things. The most interesting for me has been ketamine because I don't personally find it very therapeutic. And so this was a challenge for myself to report on a drug that I didn't think necessarily had any therapeutic benefits. And this was immediately before it became legalized by the FDA through Johnson & Johnson's new breakout drug for sort of public consumption, very marked up public consumption, but public consumption nonetheless. There was a lot of interest, and there were pharmaceutical reps there as well from Compass Pharmaceuticals. And
so it challenged your view of the uses of ketamine.
Yeah, and honestly, like, that's what I want to do with this show is a lot of the times challenge my own understanding. I do want to do a show on fentanyl later. I do want to do a show on crack, on meth, on drugs that have been much more maligned in the press, because I think that whenever I feel the sensation of fear or disgust, that it probably just underlies a lack of knowledge.
And ketamine is one of those drugs, and I know a bunch of the other ones that you've done and the ones that you've just said too. It's, you know, if you stick around long enough, these drugs go through bizarre psychic rebrandings where Special K or ketamine in the past meant one thing, and now it's a great drug for all kinds of depression or other kinds of, you know, problems with living.
Every drug seems to follow a similar path where their invention is nothing if not completely innocuous and so virtuous. And ketamine was largely, it was a synthesis of PCP and invented in the late 50s, and then adopted, used as a dissociative anesthetic for the Vietnam War. And it was massively beneficial because PCP was being used to anesthetize soldiers. And as you can imagine,
I grew up calling that angel dust
on the streets. I prefer to call these drugs by their Christian names, their God-given.
But this is to the point of that the drugs, and I know this is a given that, drugs are often perceived to be having uniquely disastrous effects on people, but in fact, the kinds of uses that they're put to, but the feelings that a particular drug will give somebody who takes it change based on expectations and a kind of larger cultural conversation.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of this is largely inspired by the fact that I'm from the Bay Area and I absolutely hate pot. I have to say, personally, my experience has only really ever
been
negative.
You had to leave then, right?
And that's why I left and I'm never going back. No, it's sort of like I realize that one, set and setting matters a lot. And a lot of the context in which people take drugs are not the best setting. But two, that the exact same drug, people can have completely different experiences coming away from it. And like, for example, one of the most ridiculously extreme examples I can think of, strychnine, one of the most neurotoxic chemicals known to man, literally a poison, was used therapeutically for a long time to get patients to open up at very low doses. But if you can use the same chemical to kill a person as to put them through therapy, it really says a lot more about us and our approach to these chemicals than it does about the chemicals themselves.
So why do you think then, kind of with that as a backdrop, why do you think hallucinogenic and psychedelic drugs, I mean, there's definitely a revival of interest. And you know, I said at the beginning, maybe of use, because it turns out that very few people actually do these kinds of drugs when you look at the National Survey of Drug Use and Health and whatnot. But, there's definitely a revival of interest in hallucinogenics and psychedelics. Why do you think that's happening now?
I have a weird theory that I've been working on, which is that I think when a lot of these psychedelics were first introduced in counterculture 60s, there was a lot of, it was like an antithesis to the parents. It was like a backlash.
That's like the way the Beatles were different than, Frank Sinatra or something.
What I'm trying to get at is actually more the emotion underlying it from the perspective of somebody who didn't live it through it. But there seemed to be some resentment of the previous generation. And what I think is going on now is instead of resentment, there's a feeling of a need to heal, that like a lot of shit went down. And instead of resenting previous generation, we need to have better methods of healing. And what I'm really getting at is like a lot of people use these drugs medicinally to heal types of trauma, sexual trauma, racial trauma, trauma from their parents. And I am sort of using the word trauma loosely, but it's a feeling of inherited baggage. But instead of rebelling against, instead of, maligning older generations, I think there's a sense of like, how do we come to terms with what happened and learn and be better and pass that on? Because when in drug history, when you bring up like MDMA up at a party, people will say, oh, what therapist do you use to integrate that experience? Right. Like, that's not how drugs are usually talked about. But I'm finding that that is so much more common, that people are talking about these drugs in such a therapeutic way. I find that very comforting.
Yeah, it's interesting too to think. I think you're right, and I want to ask a question related to that. But it's also very different in the 60s. If you read, accounts of the people trying to circulate mass doses of LSD and things like that, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, et cetera, they weren't talking about it in therapeutic terms.
They were talking about political context,
and they wanted to turn the world on and to LSD, and then everybody would love each other, and war would end, and things like that. But
right
now we're talking about it in a therapeutic setting, and I wonder if that to a certain degree, does that rob these drugs of their kind of bacchanalian excess, which or Dionysian excess, which was part of the appeal, really, like to go and become part of a throbbing organism that was a hive mind, that you were simultaneously feeling everybody else's thought and being totally on your own trip?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said on that. Like, one of the best indications that this is not so much about Dionysian excess is, like, you know, the music, the psychedelic music now is not what it used to be. Yeah. With all due respect to Tame Impala, there's like not, there's not that many bands at the forefront of like trip music. It seems like, you know, there aren't that many well-known mainstream artistic venues. Even something like the show High Maintenance has far more to do with the characters in it than it does with the drug experiences themselves. And so, yeah, there's an inwardness of drug use now, whereas before it was external, it was how do we change the world? And now I think it's a little bit more of how do I change myself?
And, you know, to go back, because obviously this is a pretext for me to brag about my own drug use.
Oh,
but no, but it's with MDMA or ecstasy, as you mentioned. Some of us could have were in a position where you could take it legally, and then when it was banned, you know, after it was banned in the mid-80s. And it's fascinating because the kind of characteristic trip or experience you would have on it changed radically from one first when it was legal. It was much more kind of you would take it and you and maybe a friend would hang out and have a really small intimate evening. After it was banned, it really became much more of a rave drug. And it was kind of, you know, so it's kind of fascinating to see even in short periods of time how quickly the kind of public identity or character of a drug can change depending on the larger discourse around it.
Yeah, I mean, these drugs often follow a similar path of entry into the mainstream where, like, a lot of the times they're used in private therapy sessions. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes a little bit more like, oh, okay, then elitist academic circles get them and they have these drug-taking parties. You see this pattern being, repeated with, obviously, LSD, but also psilocybin and MDMA and other psychedelics, and now, to a certain extent, with ayahuasca, that there's... And then you sort of see it expand outward recreational, and then there's often a backlash to that, like, oh, it's a rave drug, it's a party drug, it's a concert drug. And then it seems to fold back in on itself and then become quiet again and sort of more reflective. I'm just looking forward to when a therapist will recommend me crack.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
I wonder what the copay will be on a crack.
Well, you know, it's not
this
so
is,
far
this
off.
Is, it's all Obamacare's problem. Because
it really,
these high, you know, high deductible plans.
Though, I mean, like, much has been said about this, but like when a psychiatrist gives you a prescription for Adderall, it is very close synthesis to methamphetamine,
right,
to meth. It is... when you get morphine in surgery, that is medical grade heroin, pretty much. When ketamine is given in offices. So it's really not that far off. Like,
right,
I said that thing about crack jokingly, but it is, you know, we do live in that kind
of again, world. This is, I mean, what's exciting when you get outside of a prohibitionist mindset and you start thinking about how vastly the pharmacopoeia has expanded.
You see drugs everywhere.
Yeah, that, oddly. And that then they're immediately, that creates a continuum. And then it's question of how do you use it well?
That's the whole cognitive liberty movement and why I want to do Ambien for my next show. So the cognitive liberty movement for the, you know, 2% of your listeners who don't know what that is.
Yeah, of course.
Is... the idea that anything you put into your system affects how you think. Like right now I'm drinking tea and it's making me a little bit more awake. And obviously if I were to be taking heroin, that would affect how I speak to you. And so when
it's okay. You're not that high.
All right,
high.
I'm on
heroin. Okay, you're not that high. Okay?
Yeah, okay.
You're totally fine.
So what you ingest affects how you think, which obviously then subsequently affects what you say. So if you control substances, you are effectively controlling or having a massive impact at the least on what people are thinking and therefore what people are saying. And if we have freedom of speech in this country, then isn't the prohibition of certain substances a type of infringement of speech?
This is not I very well put. I don't think that's a new argument to longtime Reason readers, but that is where, you know, it's like this, it always ends with us pushing to have heroin vending machines in privately run charter schools.
The subtext of this conversation is you just being like, I did that before it was cool.
No. The subtext is that the libertarian.
You are a libertarian
idea,
hipster, Nick.
No,
just admit it.
No, but With that, let me ask you this then, because, you know, your show is really well researched and you have experts. I mean, not always, but typically PhDs or people have been researching these substances in really serious and rigorous ways, sometimes looking for FDA approval or going through regular channels, other times kind of culture bombing in a different way. But there's that element of kind of drug discourse. And then a lot of stuff, especially built around psychedelics and hallucinogens, is like, no, man, this is ancient mystical stuff. And, you know, magic mushrooms came from outer space and then they changed civilization. And that's why we have the pyramids. And it's this very mystical, very religious discourse. Are these things compatible, or is one of them going to kind of get crushed as we become more comfortable talking about drugs?
I think it depends on your mindset when you talk about that type of rhetoric. Because for me, I engage in it because I don't take it literally. Like, and I think one of the problems with the history of the psychedelic movement is people being a little bit overly literal rather than symbolic or metaphorical when they talk about these ideas, like Terence McKenna being a prime mm-hmm. example. There's a lot of really wonderful, interesting ideas that I don't believe, but I can entertain and see the virtue in, like the stoned ape theory mm-hmm. of evolution.
Could you explain that briefly?
Sure. There was a mystery in evolution, which was, I think, starting about 200,000 years ago, our brains make a massive evolutionary leap in terms of our brain capacity. I think it like doubles in size or something as dramatic as that. And evolutionary biologists were wondering about why. And Terence McKenna, and it might have been Dennis McKenna, I'm not mm-hmm. 100% sure.
Well, the McKenna brothers, who are famous for essentially mainstreaming magic mushrooms, or the horticulture of them.
But. Yeah, postulated this theory that a certain type of mushroom is common in the Serengeti that grows out of animal dung, which was where humans were at that time. And that perhaps an early human who had gathered these mushrooms, and having that experience of taking mushrooms might have led to a developing of empathy, which exploded our brain size and led to, you know, certain changes of how we societal changes, like how we form communities. So that's the stone ape theory. There's no way to prove it, and there's no way to disprove it. And I don't necessarily think it's true, but I think that's a really beautiful theory. And it's a wonderful thing that I probably speculate he came up with while on this material. And I think that's the beauties of, you know, psychedelics, is you can come up with these theories and not be wed too much to their veracity, but more, you know, the beauty of them.
So in that sense, it's really no different in drug culture than it is in more regular culture of, you know, you can be scientific and you can be religious, and you just kind of might hold that these are two different spheres of knowledge, or they have their different language systems.
Because, I mean, I've been sort of hearkening back to this therapy-centric view of psychedelics, but because I'm a little bit less wed, I think, to like truth, discovering truth while you're on psychedelics in the empirical sense. Like, one of the experiences people have is they see hallucinations sometimes of their parents as children. And that is so incredibly helpful for forgiving parents, for forgiving or forgiving anybody, to understand where we all come from. And obviously, that's fake. That's not true. You're not actually mm-hmm. seeing them as children. But it's such a constructive lie that it helps you to get at a deeper meaning of truth, a deeper mm-hmm. sense of truth.
I just want to point out that it's, you know, this the use of hallucinogens goes both ways, and maybe the uptick among older people taking it is it allows them to forgive their children.
Yeah, see their children as old people? Yeah. That's actually kind of interesting. No, and I've long thought that, frankly, psychedelics are best used by people, middle-aged people, because they have a lot more ingrained ways of understanding the world to upend. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting to take it, I'm 27, like to take it at my age, I hope that long-term benefits might be that I never get into a very ingrained way of thinking, or that I'll constantly be challenging my notions of myself. But I think that it has much more short-term benefits for older people.
So you mentioned that the next show might be, or is likely to be, about Ambien. Here's a question which kind of picks up on the last thing we were talking about. You know, a lot of people who are into kind of mind expansion and hallucinogens, mushrooms, LSD, things like that, take a dim view of corporate drugs or pharmaceuticals like Ambien. And it, we'll talk about the specifics of Ambien in a second, but it's kind of anything that can be sold by Johnson & Johnson or Pfizer or whatever. And yeah. I'm thinking in particular, I interviewed him about a year or six months ago or so, Tao Lin, the novelist who also wrote a book last year about psychedelics that got a fair amount of response. But he dislikes corporate drugs, but natural drugs, by which it's like hallucinogens and mushrooms and LSD, even though these are obviously made up and have their roots in corporate culture. Where do you stand on that? Is this a meaningful divide between a kind of, you know, manufactured drug and a natural drug?
There's different incentives. So in one case, you are talking about with chemists working for a pharmaceutical company mm-hmm. who have an intention. In the case of Ambien, it's to make you go to sleep. And then the side effects are what we're interested in. In the case of natural drugs, it's a plant's self-defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the mechanisms behind why you trip on, say, mushrooms or ergot, the mm-hmm. Where LSD comes from, is because the plant... instead of killing off predators who would eat it, realize that if you kill off predators who eat you, you'll then create a toxin-resistant line of predators who can then eat you. Mm-hmm. But if you make them trip, they're less likely to eat you. So plants have their own weird reason for making us trip, which is not trustworthy either. They could kill you too. And corporations, they might have an adverse incentive to make you addicted to it, mm-hmm. So long as you can be addicted but not negatively.
But functioning. So that you can still buy it.
Every substance you take, you should be suspicious of and hopefully do some research on. But I personally don't make a large divide between synthetic and natural drugs. For example, psilocybin cubensis, which is where most magic mushrooms comes from, can't exist on its own anymore. It has to be artificially helped by humans. It's like the bulldog, you know, it can't exist on its own anymore. So it is half man-made and half natural. And I think we need to quit with this understanding that stuff that's man-made is so different from what's natural. And instead apply the same amount of skepticism and curiosity to everything.
Well, one also hopes, I mean, I think it's a hallmark of the 21st century in its best kind of formulation, that we're getting away from either or kind of binary Manichaean splits between natural and man-made or whatever, or nature versus nurture. It seems across a wide variety of things, those kinds of demarcations have been replaced by a spectrum or a gradient. So,
yeah.
Which, you know...
And here's where I insert a Schrodinger's joke of some sort. Yeah. Like Schrodinger's drugs, pretty much.
Yeah. They'll get you high. Yeah, they're natural and unnatural. Yeah. And you can drive, but you're also totally fucked up.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
What about Ambien? What have you found? Because I got a prescription from Ambien. It was maybe 20 years ago or so. Ambien was seen as a wonder drug, a sleep aid.
Yeah.
I remember reading story after story about how we had become an Ambien nation. We had been a Prozac nation, then we were an Ambien nation. And now Ambien, in many ways, as a sleep aid, is getting a bad rap. A lot of doctors won't prescribe it anymore because they think it's habit forming. Roseanne Barr lost her comeback opportunity,
right,
purportedly because of Ambien use and bad tweeting as a result. What's interesting about Ambien for your show, Drug Test?
Well, one of the things I love to do in Drug Test in every show is to incorporate posters, old posters of people advocating like laudanum for, refreshing dose of heroin to cure your lady hysteria
right.
or whatever it was, because, our attitudes change more quickly than we can keep up with sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so with Ambien, it's pretty well known. I know people who talk about it casually, and I was always amazed because one of the hardest hallucinations I've ever had was on Ambien, where I was seeing men in my periphery, and they were clearly threatening. And I guess I've taken enough drugs at this point that I was more amused by this than anything. But I thought, wow, if somebody didn't have this kind of background, or they didn't appreciate how psychoactive this substance is, this could be very scary. So I looked into it, and it is massively hallucinogenic. It's called a hypnotic. It's got strange side effects that include euphoria and include paranoia, among many other things. But it also has crazy side effects where it has
in the case of one South African man, cured him of paralysis. He was in a coma, and then his caretaker noticed that he was restless, gave him Ambien, and he became functional. He woke up and walked around after about a half hour and then went back into a comatose state. It also...
I guess there was nothing really worth staying awake for. No, or, you know, it's like, I don't know.
Oh, maybe that was it.
But
yeah.
is it being used to help people in comas or paralytics?
I imagine there's some research being done on it. One of the former guests on my show, Hamilton Morris, who's big at Vice, is currently researching it out of University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. And he's doing a lot of really cool research. And that's, frankly, the only one I know about. And it's strange to me. I did hear about a study where people were curious about Roseanne Barr, about like essentially the very clickbaity title of, is racism a side effect of Ambien? And what they found was like surprisingly kind of yes. I mean, I don't know if I believe this because I think her previous tweets give a much better indication of her mindset than that one tweet.
But so the idea there is that Ambien lowers people's inhibitions.
Lowers people's inhibitions, but like strengthens, I mean, for in my case, strengthens a sense of paranoia or threat. Also, like, I think they did, I would have to check the nature of the study, but I think they, it was comorbid with a ability to like see differences in people, which is like a strange side effect to have. I would need to research that to be clear, but really strange psychological stuff can happen with this drug, and because we don't understand how it works. We don't really understand how most drugs work.
That isn't that amazing when you start to peel into, I think it's true with Ambien, it's true with things like Xanax, it's true with certain SSRIs and statin drugs to lower cholesterol. Like when you go back and look and you realize these are now being used as maintenance drugs where people, a lot of these came online in the 80s and they've been using them, you know, for 30 years on a daily basis, but there's actually no good research on long-term use.
Yeah, there really is not. And so in a way, we're all speculating. We're all, every time you put something in your mouth, like you're taking a tiny bit of a risk. And that's one of the reasons why I have this spectrum sense of psychoactive drugs, where I don't make a huge differentiation between the type, but more like I really want to push an understanding that like an understanding of this spectrum and a healthy sense of skepticism and curiosity at the same time.
So if it's, I think it's fair to say that your show kind of presupposes what I like to think of as a post-prohibitionist mindset, where we're not only legally allowed to ingest whatever substances we want, but culturally we're more free to do that, and that's part of what your show, it's what books by Michael Pollan and Tao Lin, it's Hamilton Morris's show Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia on Vice is about, kind of expanding the playing field of what is considered acceptable. How far do you think, will we know when we've reached the promised land, when will we get to a place where we're actually in that kind of mindset? What are the events or processes that need to happen to get us there?
So first I'm going to answer a question that you didn't ask, which was like, essentially why focus on a post-prohibitionist mindset? And the answer I think has to do with my favorite question to ask my experts after the show is in private.
Are you holding?
How much?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, my favorite question to ask is, does a part of you kind of hope they stay illegal? Because there is this wonderfully tender moment when things are illegal, that there's a couple of factors that happen at once. One, immense trust with other people, because we are talking about illegal substances. And so when you talk to somebody about it, it's really a show of trust with that person, as opposed to a legal substance. There's no risk involved. There's no trust involved. Two, oftentimes you have to meet in person. There's only so much you can do via Signal or Telegram or whatever. And so it's really beneficial, like, to actually meet the people in person, which is antithetical for a lot of people my age. I hate moving and seeing human faces. And I do it because I want to talk to cool people about drugs, and that's the easiest setting to do.
And there will be a time, you know, and it obviously it exists on some level, where your prescriptions will be waiting for you next to your, you know, Amazon will be delivering your prescriptions along with books and diapers and food.
Right. Yeah. I don't schlep all the way out to, you know, the middle of nowhere, Brooklyn, to talk about what I had to eat that day. Mm-hmm. But I will do it to talk about, you know, psychedelics.
So there's this tender moment you're talking about. It,
yeah.
I mean, but it's also, it's kind of tender now because the end is in sight.
Right. And so then the question becomes, what is this going to look like when these things are readily available? And I've noticed with, for example, an emergence of a phenomenon I like to call the ayahuasca bro, mm-hmm. which is a person who brags about how much ayahuasca they've done. And that is you directly tied to the proliferation of knowledge of these drugs and a bad understanding of how to take these drugs. It appeals to this weird masculine sense of the more you can do of a substance, the stronger you are, which is a prime indication of not understanding like the how to use it therapeutically, medicinally, mm-hmm. beneficially, productively. So as these things become wider spread, you start to see essentially non-productive uses of these drugs. And then it becomes clear, okay, once these actually hit the mainstream, there's going to be a deluge of people trying this stuff who might be using it in, frankly, negative ways. Negative including death, but also including just not learning anything from what these things can help you to learn. So that's why I focus on post-prohibition. How is also a different question. One of the things I've sort of been thinking about a lot is when people are fighting a war, when they have a plan for peace in mind, how that often sort of helps ensure peace for longer. So the example I think of is during World War II, like, how is it that we didn't immediately, why is it that we have a good relationship with Germany, essentially? Like, why are our relationship with Germany so good? But for example, after the Civil War, the North's relationship with the South was really strained, and some would argue is still strained today. And I think that has to do with working on a plan for peace while you're still in war. We had ideas, models for the Marshall Plan while we were fighting World War II. Same thing with Japan. We had this understanding that we have to create a peace after this is over. Whereas if you look at Reconstruction, it was, you know, vindictive. It was a debacle because there was no plan for peace. So as we're fighting this drug war, how do we come up with a plan for peace even as we're fighting? How do we have models of redemption for former DEA agents, for, you know, people who...
Joe Biden,
Jeff Sessions.
Yeah.
You know, like, how do we...
Biden is was uniquely positioned to be the, you know, I won't call him the Hitler of the drug war because mm-hmm. he wasn't that center all the time, but he has a uniquely bad record of contemporary politicians.
I didn't know about that. I only know about Jeff Sessions to me as the big bad. And I look forward one day to smoking a joint with Jeff Sessions if I can manage to make it happen. Like, I went to this meeting after the Horizons conference, which is like the Oscars of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And I saw Rick Doblin
Except
speak.
That people actually, like, people want to host it.
Yeah, actually want to host it, yeah. And I saw Rick Doblin speak, and something absolutely beautiful happened. He said, I'm going to go to this conference in Florida for police chiefs, and Donald Trump is going to be there. Now, he's saying this to a room at the assemblage, this, like, very liberal elitist group, like, that I love, but it's, like, very wealthy, right, anti-Donald Trump people. After he said, I'm going to go to a conference where Trump will be there, there was silence. And then somebody said, send him our love. Mm. And people started nodding in agreement. And I've never seen that happen. I'm a comedian as well as a ridiculous drug show host. I've never seen this happen in a room before where a group of New Yorkers would say, send Donald Trump our love. Like, there really is a sense that, like, we can finally show empathy to people we had conflicts with before. And that is just humans at their finest hour.
And it's fascinating. I spoke earlier this week with Jacob Sullum, my colleague, about how virtually, with the exception of Biden, virtually all the presidential candidates, including Donald Trump, I mean, he's the incumbent, but have signed on to letting states decide their marijuana policies. And even 4 years ago, that was off the table. Trump was in favor of that. Bernie Sanders was. Hillary Clinton was not. So we're seeing this weird movement towards something different than the drug war as we've known it for the past 40 or 50 years.
And I'm really fascinated by how that has happened with pot, because I really don't know what happened. Like, is it because people started using it more? Is it because people knew people using it more? Is it because we understood the medicinal benefits? Is it because we understood more about it? Is it because people were just more public when they supported it? Is it all of those things? Like, I'm just fascinated by how that happened.
Yeah, I suspect that it's a combination of all of those things, including people like Rick Doblin of MAPS, who is not with pot so much as with certain types of hallucinogenics, working within the system to have the FDA and the government actually approve the use of certain types of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I cannot say anything kind I could say is not kind enough about Rick Doblin, because the guy's been at the forefront of this debate for so long, like 40 years now, I think, and is still, he has the enthusiasm of me, like he of somebody who is only recent
of
to
somebody
this
who's a regular user of
it's a hair who's psychoactive drugs.
Where is the best place to get more information about drug tests?
I was going to say drugs.
Yeah, about drugs. Now, I think we all have our favorite connection for that.
I got this guy, Kevin.
Yeah. But where is the best place to go to find information about drug tests?
I have a Facebook page. It's just called Drug Test with Sarah Rose Siskin. I'm hoping to do, I don't know, something for people who don't live in New York City, like maybe a podcast or a YouTube channel. I'm not 100% sure. But if you are in New York City, it's monthly. And so check out the Facebook page, Drug Test with Sarah Rose Siskin, or just friend me. I don't know. I assume that this podcast doesn't reach that many people, right?
Well, we're going to find out. You know, it's many of the people it does reach are hallucinations. So,
okay.
You know, it'll be interesting to figure out who is real and who is not. We're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Sarah Rose Siskin. She is a former Reason contributor for Mostly Weekly, but now is running a monthly show held at the Caveat Theater in New York City called Drug Test. It's a great resource. Check it out, and check out her Facebook page for Drug Test with Sarah Rose Siskin. This has been a product of our Weed Week coverage. Please look at the Weed Week header at Reason.com, and you'll see all of the stories and podcasts and things that we've done that are related to that. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please, if you like what you hear, subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, or at Reason.com. Thanks for listening.